It's a real pleasure to be here. What time should I finish?
We should finish
at
1 o'clock.
The clock has been, okay. One, all right, 35 minutes, right? Okay. It's a pleasure to be here. I was asking myself as I prepared, well, why would this issue be particularly relevant for a group of physicians and other healthcare professionals like yourselves? By the way, quick show of hands, how many of you are physicians? Most of you. Nurses? And then educators, fertility educators? Okay, great, thanks. Why would this be relevant to you? And my guess is that it's relevant because, although I realize now I need to stand here, don't I? Sorry. Although I will stay here in front of the camera. Although we've been hearing some remarkable accounts of what you do, what you provide, what you say yes to, in the background are also many things that I would guess many of you say no to. We've talked about in vitro fertilization, and I gather that there are probably many of you here who, even if you have the capacity to provide in vitro fertilization, would not provide in vitro fertilization. And as you seek to restore the reproductive capacity of those for whom that capacity is diminished in some way, you are doing that with certain limitations. So it brings up an issue that's become very controversial in a new way. It's an old issue, but it's become kind of newly controversial, and that's the issue that is now goes under the heading of conscientious refusals. I'm going to speak somewhat from the United States experience, trying to draw attention to differences where I'm aware of them, but you can fill me in either at lunch or maybe at Q&A time about other differences that you might draw. What I want to do is just briefly help us think about the place of conscience in the practice of medicine, to argue that the profession of medicine for its own good needs to allow for a wide space for healthcare professionals to conscientiously refuse to provide practices which they cannot provide in good conscience. That they need to allow a broad, not an unlimited space, you can't say no to anything, but a wide array of space, and that's essential for the profession to remain a profession, and to remain a profession in which physicians can trust that their patients can trust that their physicians are committed to their good. And let me try to explain why that's so. And I'll start with just some basic facts about which I think none of us would disagree. The first fact is that at times patients request interventions or services to which their physicians have moral objections. Sometimes those physicians refuse to provide a requested intervention on the basis that they cannot do so in good conscience. Sometimes they also refuse to refer the patient to a provider who would accommodate the request. That's the first fact. The second is that many people find these refusals to be offensive, morally meddlesome, and medically consequential. So in some cases, patients feel as if they've been judged and even abandoned. In some cases, the effort to find an accommodating provider costs the patient significant time and money. In some cases, patients are not able to find a provider within the window of the effectiveness of the intervention which the provider refuses or the clinician refuses. That was particularly salient in the United States, and my guess is also here, with respect to emergency contraception, before it was made available without prescription. Now, I also, that's the second fact. The third is I take it as a premise that patients have a legal right to seek the full range of legal and professionally accepted, professionally permitted interventions, medical interventions, and that they have an interest in being able to obtain what they seek. And I would concede, I think we all should concede here, that physicians' refusals are made more problematic and consequential for patients because professional licensing rules make physicians, again, I'm going to kind of speak predominantly about physicians, but I think this applies to other professional domains within healthcare. But they make physicians the gatekeepers to most of these interventions. That's true here in Ireland as much as in the United States, although it is less true in some countries. And we can, with that in mind, we can start also with a narrow public consensus about how physicians should respond when patients request interventions to which the physician has an objection. Everyone, I think, agrees that physicians should respond respectfully. Right, they shouldn't belittle patients. They shouldn't denigrate them. And we would, I think, agree that respect for the patient requires physicians to be candid and forthcoming, taking care to not deceive or mislead the patients about the reasons for their refusals and the options available. So I think we should be able to agree that a physician should not say to someone, oh, that's not available anywhere here, when they know that that's not true. Or that's not available in this district, when they know that that's not true. That would be deception. Yet beyond this limited area of consensus, there are neither uncontroversial nor surgically precise solutions to the dilemmas posed by conscientious refusals. Now, with that introduction, let's try to unpack what conscientious refusals are and how they relate to the practice of medicine, and why trying to get rid of them is, I think, a very bad idea. Now, the first thing we need to pay attention to within medicine is that something that we all know, regardless of how we feel about a given person's objection or not, and that is that doctors, good doctors, regularly refuse to provide clinical interventions that patients request, even when those interventions are legal and when they're permitted by the medical profession. So that's to say, to borrow the unfortunate and misleading rhetoric that's often thrown about in this issue, that we physicians often impose our values on patients, and that we cannot think, in fact, of a good physician who does not. So these refusals are neither peripheral to new or peripheral to clinical practice. So in taking the Hippocratic Oath, physicians for centuries in the West have sworn to categorically refuse to provide either abortifacients or any drug or information that would be used to help kill patients. Sometimes physicians refuse interventions that are subject to widespread dispute, something like emergency contraception or in vitro fertilization in some quarters. More often, their refusals occasion little controversy. Surgeons refuse to operate when they believe a surgery is unlikely to be successful, whether or not their colleagues agree with them. Physicians refuse requests for antibiotics or other remedies if the patient's symptoms, even if the patient's symptoms, satisfy some threshold criteria for using those medications. Physicians may refuse requested interventions because of concerns about safety or efficacy, or they may refuse because of concerns that are less tangible but no less real. So some Catholic physicians will refuse to provide contraceptive medications because the Roman Catholic Church teaches that such medications illicitly separate the procreative and unitive aspects of human sexuality. More commonly, even physicians' intangible concerns are not explicitly religious. So pediatricians sometimes will refuse to provide growth hormone injection to boys who are particularly short because of concern about crossing a line between treatment and enhancement. Internists and family doctors, or GPs, I think they're called here, sometimes refuse intensive workups and treatment regimens for what they believe are psychosomatic syndromes because they're concerned about being a good steward of their colleagues' time and of the shared medical resources. OBGYNs who would, of course, in the United States, you know that abortion is legal. OBGYNs there who will abort fetuses with lethal congenital anomalies may refuse to abort those with Down syndrome or cleft palate out of a concern for societal attitudes toward those with disability. So refusing patient requests is central to the practice of medicine. You cannot imagine, I would argue, a good physician, unless they're a radiologist perhaps, but a good physician who does not regularly refuse patient requests for legal medical interventions. So the question then comes, well, what makes a refusal conscientious? The Oxford English Dictionary defines conscience as the faculty or principle which pronounces upon the moral quality of one's own actions or motives, approving the right and condemning the wrong. Okay? The conscience is merely the human capacity that judges your own, my own actions, the ones I've already taken and the ones that I'm about to take. So to say a refusal is conscientious is simply to say that it is based on a physician's best judgment about what he or she ought to do in a given case. It's their judgment about what the right thing to do is. These refusals need not be based on religious reasons, even though that's often suggested that, well, these are people are putting their personal religious moral values into their professional sphere, and I'll get to that in a moment. They need not be that. They need not be emotional or dramatic or obscure. They're just refusals based on what the doctor thinks is good or good reasons. And conscientious refusals are central to the practice of medicine, but that does not mean that all conscientious refusals are justified. So a conscience that is malformed or misinformed will err. I'll just give you a simple example. Suppose a patient who has debilitating pain syndrome, seeks narcotic pain medication from his physician. And suppose the physician doesn't think that treating pain is that big of a deal. She doesn't care about treating pain. Then she might fail in her duty to adequately treat that pain because her conscience is malformed. It hasn't been formed properly to recognize the gravity, the need to treat significant pain. Alternatively, she may see the same patient and really be committed to treating pain, but for a variety of different signs, think that that patient is actually malingering, is drug-seeking, and refuse to give the pain medicine. And if she's wrong, if she misinterprets the symptoms, then she fails in her obligation. Not because her conscience is malformed, because it's misinformed. She's not getting the right information. So the conscience as a human faculty is both limited and fallible. And that's something we should always readily concede. But however fallible, conscientious refusals are a necessary consequence of physicians exercising discernment or clinical judgment. So I'm making the point so far here that the term conscientious refusals refers to a broad category of physician refusals. And with respect to contemporary controversies, it can't be said that conscientious refusals per se are ethically problematic. As we've said, they're all throughout medicine. What we're after, what we have to be after, is some criteria by which to distinguish those refusals that are consistent with physicians' professional obligations from those refusals that contradict their professional obligations. And to find those criteria, we have to think about and figure out what, in fact, physicians are obligated to do as physicians. Now, it's been self-evident to people from every culture, virtually every culture and every moral tradition throughout the centuries, that physicians are obligated to care for the sick so as to preserve and restore their health. The Hippocratic Oath states, "Into whatever houses I enter, I will go into them for the benefit of the sick." And this universally recognized obligation still provides a powerful criterion by which we can discern that some refusals, however conscientious, are incompatible with good medical practice. So I'm going to give you a couple examples. If a physician who refuses to care for a patient with HIV because of his antipathy toward homosexuals, or it's been brought up in the U.S., a physician who refuses to care for African-American patients because of racial prejudice, or for criminals because of revulsion at their crimes, that physician thereby violates his or her constitutive professional obligation, which is to seek the health of patients precisely because they are sick, precisely because their health is diminished or threatened without regard to their other characteristics. However, and this is crucial and often overlooked in these debates, this obligation to seek health does not provide a criterion by which to condemn the sorts of conscientious refusals that have stirred today's controversies. Rather, as biomedical science has expanded, it's made possible many uses of medical technology that are not so obviously directed to preserving and restoring health. Examples include terminal sedation, growth hormone for short children, or as we've learned in the U.S. at least for professional athletes, particularly Tour de France bicyclists, cosmetic surgery, many assisted reproductive technologies, elective abortion, and others. Interestingly, the paradigmatic case or the paradigmatic example of such interventions and the one that really continues to animate disputes about conscientious refusals is contraception. In 1979, 20 years after the FDA in the United States, Federal Food and Drug Administration, approved the first oral contraceptive there, Mark Siegler and Ann Dudley Goldblatt, two colleagues of mine, wrote the following. The oral contraceptive medication was the first prescription drug that was and is, in effect, a self-prescribed treatment. Patients, i.e. medical consumers desiring elective medication, demanded that physicians prescribe the contraceptive pill. Other popularly self-prescribed medications soon followed and came to be seen as appropriate solutions or treatments for problems previously considered individual or social concerns, but in any case not biological abnormalities or specific diseases. The pill was the first technology that absolutely blew apart and staggered the kind of consensus end of medicine being health. Everybody wanted it. It involved human physiology. Doctors understand human physiology. Well, doctors will be licensed to provide it, and the rest is history. But for a long time, from the beginning, there have been physicians who refused to provide this technology and many that have followed it. And for a long time, those refusals were relatively uncontroversial. The medical profession has traditionally given wide latitude to physician discretion in areas of disagreement. Right? If you think one surgery works better than another and there's a real dispute within the profession has not come and said, these guys win, you guys have to quit doing what you're doing. Unless the weight of evidence starts to tilt the balance in a really striking way. Codes have consistently stated, professional codes, that physicians are not obligated to satisfy patients' requests for interventions that the physician does not believe is in the interest of the patient's health. In the United States, physician and pharmacist refusals became more controversial recently because of the emergence of postcoital contraceptives. So if you... for better or worse, physicians have an exclusive license, had an exclusive license, to administer this technology by which millions of American women came to order their lives. And with respect to most other technologies, if one physician will not provide what a patient seeks, the patient can go to another who will. Dr. Boyle, in his talk this morning, said something to the effect of, well, patients say, I want to get IVF. You say, well, that, you can always do that. You can make that choice. There's no critical time urgency with that. But that was not true for emergency contraception. Obviously, it has a limited window of effectiveness. And so there were cases in which a patient sought the technology, sought emergency contraception. Her physician refused to write a prescription, or a pharmacist refused to fill that prescription. And probably in some handful of cases, a woman became pregnant as a result, who would not have become pregnant had she been able to take the technology. So that led to a real firestorm of complaint by many people. And what since then, there have been a whole slew of people who, within the medical profession and the bioethics community, who have argued that doctors must provide or facilitate access to all legal and professionally accepted medical technologies, notwithstanding their moral obligation or their moral objections. These arguments, in every case, and I've read virtually all of them, and in every case in my reading, depend on a distinction, a moral distinction, and a tension between the personal and the professional. And this is sometimes posed as a personal moral values, professional ethical obligations, personal conscience, professional conscience, personal professional integrity, personal beliefs, professional responsibilities. These are all quotes from different authors. And this, the idea is that you must separate these two. And what's happening here is problematically is doctors are forgetting that these are supposed to be kept separate. and they're allowing the personal to bleed over to their professional, and that's a violation of their professional responsibilities. Unfortunately, this pitting of personal versus professional tends to beg the relevant moral question, which we've already talked about. Because unless and until we can specify our professional obligations, we cannot know whether they are being violated, nor can we know which obligations are merely personal. Notice, if you have occasion to talk to people about this issue, and they bring up this personal versus professional, which they will if they're critical of these refusals, we'll say, oh, why are they personal values? Ask them, what does personal mean when you use the term personal values? What makes a value a personal value as opposed to a professional one? And what you'll find with a little bit of questioning is that personal means nothing here except not professional. I mean, imagine someone saying to someone, imagine that a medical student who's about to choose her field says, I love taking care of women who are pregnant and helping them give birth in a healthy way. I value that personally. And someone would say, well, you need to not do that. Because if you did that, that would be letting your personal values influence your professional practice. Of course, that's absurd. So the only way this can make sense is when personal means nothing but not professional. So the key is to ask people, well, how do you decide what our professional commitments are? What are those commitments? Everything turns on how we define the substance of our professional obligations, because at the heart of every controversy about physician refusals is a debate about what medicine is for. As biomedical science generates new technologies that people desire to use, questions are raised as to whether those uses are really directed at health, objectively defined. If not, then some argue for a broadening of the concept of health, and that concept has been getting broader and broader and broader to justify the use of the new technology. Or they would argue that physicians are obligated to pursue a new goal in addition to health. In 1982, the President's Commission, this is in the United States, the President's Commission for the Study of Ethical Problems in Medicine and Biomedical and Behavioral Research pointed to the awkwardness that's been introduced by these expansions of medicine's goals. They said, judgments of conscientious persons have become divergent and perplexed, and societal consensus does not exist. No longer are the proper ends and limits of healthcare commonly understood and broadly accepted. A new concept of healthcare characterized by changing expectations and uncertain understanding between patient and practitioner is evolving. The need to find an appropriate balance of the rights and responsibilities of patients and healthcare professionals in this time of change has been called the critical challenge facing medicine in the coming decades. So I think the present controversies show that that challenge remains. If anything, the challenge has become more pointed and intense. Those who frame conscientious refusals as a conflict, therefore, between personal values and professional obligations are taking one side in a debate that they rarely acknowledge. They invoke a conflict between the personal and the professional, or between physicians' interests and patients' health. That's another common thing that's said. Shouldn't you put the patient's interests first? Or physicians' personal beliefs and patients' best interests, without addressing disagreements about whether the intervention in question is really health-related, or whether the intervention is required to preserve the patient's best interest. So without acknowledging so, the authors are exchanging physicians' historical commitment to seek patients' health for a novel so-called professional commitment to provide healthcare services. I don't know if that language has switched as decisively here as in the United States, but it's stunning how decisively it is now. Physicians are rarely called physicians anymore. They're called providers. And what do people provide? Healthcare services, right? We don't care for the sick. We don't seek health. We provide healthcare services in an efficient and competent way. And they've even, in the words of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology Ethics Committee, their new commitment is to seek the patient's well-being as the patient perceives it. Now obstetrics and gynecology discipline's official position. Your obligation as an OBGYN is to seek the patient's well-being as the patient defines it. And that's a pretty dramatic change of the goals of medicine. In so doing, these efforts to rein in conscientious refusals end up promoting, I think, a provider-consumer ideal for medicine that has been widely criticized, interestingly, in other quarters for being insufficient for and even corrosive of the practice of medicine. It's a series over the past 3 decades, a series of influential clinicians and ethicists who disagree on a great many other moral questions have agreed that the pendulum has swung too far from away from physician paternalism toward an emphasis on patient autonomy that amounts to what the President's Commission called patient sovereignty. In the paternalism model, remember this, in the paternalism model, the physician ordered and the patient obeyed. After the patient's rights movement, I think there was a real corrective aspect of that movement, a good one. But after the patient's rights movement, the physician proposed and the patient gave consent. And probably the truth is that's predominantly what happened for centuries. Physician proposes, patient gives consent. In the patient sovereignty model, or what Quill and Brody have called the independent choice model, the patient proposes and the physician provides. And in this transaction, the physician loses both agency and responsibility. So arguments for reining in conscientious refusals, I think, logically depend on this latter model, this consumer-provider model, being the right one for medicine. Only if the physician-patient relationship is one of provider-consumer or technician-client can patients' long-standing legal right to seek biomedical interventions be transformed into a new professional obligation for physicians to provide whatever patients seek. Only then can informed consent be redefined, as it has been redefined by many, as informed choice. Only then can physicians' obligation to care for the sick be exchanged for an obligation to provide healthcare services toward the goal of maximizing well-being as the patient perceives it. Now, some would welcome the prospect of physicians answering to their patients regarding what is good for them. After all, if these technologies that are controversial are not directly related to restoring health, they're at least something like a medical commodity. They're a healthcare service, to use that language. And if they're not related to health, then physicians have no particular expertise or standing to determine whether and how autonomous individuals put such commodities to use. An independent choice model for the doctor-patient relationship would improve access to these services while reducing patients' risk of surprise and embarrassment. The model would bring simplicity, efficiency, choice, and control. If some physicians do not like providing the services, they can quit. Now, that is an option. And we do have a choice. And interestingly, as with all such choices, the choice will be made through all the instruments of politics, including the deliberations and actions in Ireland of the Medical Council. The profession can continue to ask its members to commit themselves to an objective goal, namely health, that is not subject to wholesale revision. And if that commitment is maintained, the profession has to allow conscientious refusals where there is reasoned dispute within the profession about whether a given intervention is consistent with that goal, consistent with the goal of health. Or the profession may constrain the scope of conscientious refusals and move toward a provider-consumer model in which physicians' moral and clinical judgment is irrelevant to their task of providing what patients lawfully seek. But we can't have it both ways. And I'm going to, sort of wrapping up here, I'm going to describe 3 logical consequences, I think, if unintended. I think they are largely unintended, but they're necessary consequences if we take this latter route. And these are reasons to not take this route. First, any policy that constrains the scope of conscientious refusals thereby erodes the possibility of conscientious practice. So I think it seems obvious, certainly seems obvious to most people I talk to, that patients want their physicians to be conscientious insofar as possible. Who wants a physician who's in the habit of doing things that he or she knows to be unethical? Fortunately, individuals from virtually all moral traditions and communities can conscientiously commit themselves to caring for the sick. That's why the profession of medicine has been able to maintain both prestige and unity, both in European nations the more North American context, in societies that are made up of many different moral communities. But if physicians must be willing to participate in contraception and sterilization, then those who believe what the Roman Catholic Church has taught for centuries about the body and human sexuality, and those who believe that physicians should aim at health and nothing else, will no longer be able to practice conscientiously. If physicians are required to refer patients to providers of abortion when requested in the United States, then those who believe that such referral makes them complicit in a gravely immoral action will have to quit practicing medicine. And so the process goes. Every time the scope of conscientious refusals is narrowed, the pool of people who can be conscientious physicians is reduced. And eventually the only ones left are those who are willing to make all legal medical technology available to be used by patients according to the patient's own judgment. So that's the first problem. The second is that by requiring physicians to do what patients request, we set physicians and patients at odds with one another. Quill and Brody, interestingly, who have no objections to most of these technologies. Timothy Quill is one of the probably the best known advocate for physician-assisted death in the United States. But even he has argued that the independent choice model, this provider-consumer model, makes the physician as a person with values and experience an impediment to rather than a resource for decision-making. And I would add that the patient becomes a moral threat to the physician, particularly if restrictions on conscientious refusals take on the force of professional legislative policy. There have been cases in Ireland where patients become a threat to their physician. If the physician is going to be required to do that which he or she believes is unethical, and the patient, so all they got to do is ask you, can I be your patient? And then the physician knows, well, if that patient turns around and asks me for that thing and I won't provide it, they become a source of liability for me. That's a terrible thing, I think, to do to the doctor-patient relationship. What the conscientious refusal has done forever is give a release valve where neither person coerces the other, so that if they can't come to an accommodation about how they're going to work together, they can break off. Obviously, there are the boundary issues of emergency situations and so on, but in virtually all cases, they could say, you know what, I can't work with you on that. You know what, I can't be your patient if you won't do that. Okay. But if you start making laws that punish the doctors, then that doesn't work anymore. Patient becomes a threat. The third consequence is that by reducing the scope of conscientious refusals, patients lose the basis for trusting that their physicians are committed to their good. And to me, this is the most important problem. Under the old model of paternalism, patients could trust that physicians had committed themselves to the patient's best interest, even if in a limited way, only insofar as those interests included restoring and preserving health. The patient's rights movement and the rise of the doctrine of informed consent qualified and delimited physicians' commitment to pursue health. Out of respect for persons, physicians are to act only with the permission of their patients. Because health is a relative rather than an absolute good, patients are authorized to relativize that good to other concerns, such as not being overburdened by medical technology or not spending so much money on their treatment. Yet within the limit of only acting on a patient with his or her at least implied consent, physicians remained in that model committed to the patient's best interest, at least insofar as that interest includes health. Now, but models that support constraining conscientious refusals differ in this fundamental way. In them, the patients not only relativize the good of health to other concerns, so they not only say, Doc, I know that treatment would get me, reduce my risk of a heart attack, but I don't want to feel the way I feel when I take a statin and or spend $300 a month, so I'm just not going to do it. Okay, that's relative. I see health. Health is a good. Feeling good is a good. Saving my money and using it on a trip to Naples is a good. I'm not going to make that choice. Not only do they do that, but they also define which goods the physicians will seek. Patients gain a technician committed to cooperation, but they necessarily, in the same transaction, lose a healer committed to beneficence. So by gaining control over their physicians, they divest the physicians of responsibility. You cannot say to someone, you must do this thing, And if it goes wrong, you're responsible. That doesn't work. You can't make a person is not responsible unless they have agency, unless they have judgment, unless they have freedom to act. And so physicians are responsibilities taken away. And so physicians can wash their hands of patients' decisions so long as the physician gives accurate information and provides technically proficient healthcare services. I see this a lot, interestingly, in the end-of-life context, where we've seen this shift, at least in the United States, such an emphasis on patients' autonomy and patients' rights that when people are in their most vulnerable and families have no idea what to do, you see the physician sort of backing away and saying, we're just here to give you information. You know, this ain't our responsibility, what happens to your mother. We can give you lots of information. We can give you some ideas, but then you're going to have to decide. And that's what they're doing is basically saying, since you want to make the decision, and since our culture says you're supposed to, we can't be held responsible. We're just giving you information and options here. I think that's an abandonment of patients. So you cannot merely constrain the scope of conscientious refusals and leave everything else the same. If you devalue conscientious practice or make conscientious practice more difficult, you reduce that which has historically made the practice of medicine its own reward, which is the confidence and the conviction, the feedback that what you're doing is very good. That you come home at the end of the day and you think, that work was worthy work. It may have been hard, it may have been tedious, it may have been frustrating, but in the end, if I sum it all up, I'd say that was worthwhile. But if you're out there being told, if you're being asked to do things that you know are wrong, it cuts the legs out from under that that aspect of medicine. Patients, I'll close by proposing, I think there's a better way. It's been articulated again and again, which is that physicians should practice conscientiously rather than retreating from conscience. They should go further into conscience, think about what they're doing, practice conscientiously, and be candid about what they're doing. Learn to give voice to why you do what you do, to tell people why you practice NAPRO technology, why you're a part of this institute, why you seek to restore health in the way you do. And where there's ambiguity or dispute about whether a particular practice belongs in medicine, physicians and patients have to negotiate as best they can, respectfully, some accommodation that does not require either to do what they believe is unethical. In that model, physicians would never feign a kind of moral neutrality. They wouldn't sort of say, well, my personal stuff is all locked away. I'm just professional here. But instead would tell patients frankly what the options are, which one the physician is willing to provide, why the physician recommends one over the other. And until and unless consensus is forged regarding the ends of medicine, these refusals cannot be shown to violate physicians' professional obligations. And in the meantime, the practice of medicine, I think, should be open to anyone who is willing to unreservedly commit herself to caring for the sick so as to preserve and restore their health. Thank you.